This is interviewing Dr. Towns, October 5th, 1971.
Yeah. Well, I have had a number of encounters with radio astronomy in various ways. Perhaps one would say, well, I've flirted with the field for quite a while without being as terribly active in it or full-time in it. I first ran into this radiation in an elementary physics textbook in the early 30s when I was in college. And it struck me then as a tremendously interesting observation of radio waves, which at that time had completely unexplained.
Do you remember which textbook it was? Just,
I think it was a text by Jonsi called Modern Physics. It was a sort of a junior level general physics. General
I just have to take a look at that, just,
yeah.
Just for my own interest.
I think it was Jonsi. I'd have to, I can't be certain. I believe that's where it was. After completing my PhD, going to the Bell Telephone Laboratories, where I was expected to do other kinds of physics, getting involved in the war effort. It was in the mid-40s that I found that I had a little time waiting around between airplane flights and testing motor equipment to do something more interesting to me, and I decided to look into what might be the source of these waves. Since I was at Bell Telephone Laboratory, it was easy for me to talk to Jansky, and I went down and visited him and had a very, very interesting visit. And he gave me additional data that was not readily available.
Can you be a little more specific? Was this stuff he did after his publications? Or?
This was particularly measurements at very long wavelength, intensity of radiation at long wavelength, which had never been properly published and hadn't been called the attention of the astronomical community. I first calculated the essentially the Bremsstrahlung from collisions of electrons with particles along with various other processes. I decided this was likely the source of the radiation. And just as I was writing this up, I discovered that essentially the same calculation had been made for X-rays a number of years ago by Dutch physicists. I've forgotten the name for the moment. So, of course, I referred to that work, and this ended in a publication, a discussion of essentially the thermal, what's now known as the thermal process for an ionized medium. I integrated it over over thermal distribution. I'm not sure that paper is very well known.
No, I.
It was not an active field at the time. And one of the things I tried to do was to correct one or two previous expressions for such thermal radiation, one of which had the constant H in it. And I was sure that this was really a classical phenomenon. And I tried to show why that constant H had come in by mistake and what the mistake was. The reviewers, as it turned out, said, well, this was not interesting to show that quantum mechanics and classical mechanics were similar. And I took that out, essentially, except the comment that the H really shouldn't be in there. In fact, it was a demonstration that that the earlier calculation based on sort of spontaneous emission processes really wasn't right. And then I examined the experimental data, including the new experimental data that Jansky had pointed out to me, analyzed it. In terms of thermal mechanism, thinking at that time, well, perhaps interstellar medium really was very hot as a million degrees, because it would take that to explain everything by this mechanism. Now we know that some of that mechanism is a principal source in some places of synchrotron radiation, which I hadn't imagined was more important.
Now where is this published, please?
That was published in the Astrophysical Journal, 1945 or 6, actually.
And do you give the numbers that for this long wavelength data of Jansky's in there?
Yes, it's in there, I believe. Yeah.
So that's actually the only mention of it in the literature.
Well, at least the only mention in the astronomical literature. I think he may have had it in some electrical engineering publication or something like this. I, at the same time, was thinking about various kinds of molecular transitions. I had gotten interested in the trouble which water absorption would produce for radar, because I was working on K-band radar, somewhat over my own objections. It had been rule that we should all convert to K-band radar, and I felt that the water would likely give that radar trouble. But such was the military discipline of the time that I had to work on it nevertheless. And so I went to some considerable trouble in odd hours to try to show that, in fact, this was likely to give difficulty, but I never convinced my superiors until, in fact, did run into difficulty. And the equipment was junk, but thereby that made equipment available for microwave spectroscopy, which I later used. And through the study of water, I got quite interested in molecular spectroscopy. About that same time, I worked actually on a number of different processes, some astronomical, some in the laboratory, thinking about them. And the hydrogen hyperfine structure was one of the things that I calculated. I believe a number of people actually did independently of Purcell, or several people did independently of Purcell and the Dutch group.
Are you talking during the war, Stoner?
During the war, yes.
Did Purcell do this during the war also? I thought I knew about Van der Hulst during the war.
Yeah, Van der Hulst and Purcell both, I think, thought about it during the war or immediately after. But I just calculated it worked on it in my notes. I think Professor Lamb also made that kind of an estimate of what might be done from astronomical sources. And along with looking at what might be done with ammonia in the laboratory and a variety of other things, I never did anything serious about the hydrogen fine structure case of feeling that, well, I should go try to measure it. I decided to do laboratory work and microwave spectroscopy because I foresaw a big field there. And Reber had by that time come out with his maps of the sky, and of course I had located those and found them very interesting and helpful. I had a somewhat difficult choice between radio astronomy and what I saw as a new field of microwave spectroscopy. I can't really detail the precise reasons why I chose the latter now, excepting that it was easier to do in the Bell Telephone Laboratories at that time.
Yeah.
They had no substantial telescopes. I could work in my own laboratory with relatively small equipment and with this equipment which was cast off from military radar, and which was cheap and easy to get. So that field developed so interestingly and quickly that
So you weren't in that before the war, then, or was there any microwave spectroscopy?
There was no real microwave spectroscopy before the war, at least no high-resolution work. There was some rudimentary work on water vapor absorption at atmospheric pressure by Dickey, from looking at the atmosphere and his radiometer, and at Columbia University by Lamb and others in a box at room temperature and atmospheric pressure to try to check this problem with radar to see what the problem, how big the problem really was. It was measured just about the same time that one found operationally that the radar was knocked out by water vapor.
Was that only during rain, or was that just even?
No, just any moderately humid day, and particularly since the war with Japan was on and of importance, prime importance then, in the South Pacific, where there's great humidity, the radar was just thrown essentially discarded immediately. And that was learned for sure. There had been a great deal of effort on it prior to that. Now, there was also some work on ammonia. I knew that a few people had worked with ammonia, getting absorption of microwaves. Of course, there was the Clayton-Williams work in the 30s, which first discovered this transition of ammonia at atmospheric pressure in very broad smear. Other people had worked at high pressure, too. I think some work at RCA, some work at Oxford, Blini at Oxford, and Hirschberger, perhaps, Wolf at RCA. And the thing that I thought could be added then was new, is what I realized that one could go down to lower pressures and just get almost arbitrarily high resolution, and I think that wasn't generally appreciated. And so what I set out to do was to go down to low pressures and get high resolution. And it was a high pressure atmospheric work which had been done in a rudimentary form before, so it was started during the war for military purposes actually, but only in this high pressure form. After the war, then at Bergen, there were three independent places that first did the high-resolution work. Myself at Bell Telephone Laboratories, Blini at Oxford, and Coles and Good at Westinghouse. And it was a very active field for a long time, very enjoyable field. Then, when the Mesas came along...
Well, hold on, before you jump that much.
Yeah.
Was you or your group the first to measure the ammonia and water lines accurately, the 1 centimeter?
we first measure the water line accurately.
And what time was this? And I'm particularly interested in that one, of course.
Yeah, well, let me see. It was late 45 or early 46. A paper on, a fairly extensive paper on ammonia in 46. Blini got fairly high resolution on ammonia, and I remember very well we had I had a paper which was being cleared by the Bell Laboratories Patent Office at the time. It had been cleared, and I had it in the mailbox to send off to the Physical Review, and I got a preprint of Blini's work, so I tore it up. But then we went on and did a more extensive job and more precise job in getting the frequencies accurately and predicting and understanding the frequencies, and wrote a longer paper later. But Blini was the first to get fairly high resolution. We, I think, were the first to measure it accurately, first to detect saturation phenomena.
And what about for the water vapor?
For water vapor, we were the first to detect that on an accurate basis, other than atmospheric pressure. Yeah. That was done by Merritt and myself, and Holden, I believe, maybe.
That was just sure a one-page paper.
Yes, that's right. And then was also HDO, a variety, because we worked on a variety of molecules then, and a number of them I remember quite here, the same molecules that have been turning up. OCS was a great testbed for microwave spectroscopy, as was ammonia. In fact, it's interesting that many of the new things, that as I start on a new field, ammonia seems to be a kind of a test case. Ammonia was the origin of the maser, of course, the first maser, and our first work in molecules in space, and tested a lot of hyperfine theory, transition theory, and so on through ammonia. It was a very good molecule. Well, now, let's see. I continue to be interested in radio astronomy, but simply too occupied with another field to do very much about it. I took a sabbatical shortly after the maser had been discovered and made to work, and to try to decide what I should do, feeling that work for physicists in microwave spectroscopy was no longer as interesting and no longer as needed, because the chemists were doing a good job, and I felt from then on it was be more efficiently done in chemistry laboratories.
This is a sabbatical taken
where? Taken in 55-56. Took sabbatical in France and in Japan.
From Columbia.
And while I was in Paris, I worked a moderate amount on various astronomical problems. Radio astronomy, I remember talking with Denise at some length about some of these problems and a certain number of calculations of things that I thought might be going on in interstellar space and various radiating objects.
Was this all spectral line?
Some of it was continuum. And thinking about what might be done, I eventually decided that I would, in fact, pretty much drop microwave spectroscopy per se and work on masers and their extensions, including a maser amplifier for radio astronomy. So we built, Jordemain, Elsop, and I built a Ruby maser eventually to do astronomy with, and that was put on a telescope through very, very happy cooperation with NRL. I think that was the first maser to be used telescopic for astronomical purposes.
But that was simply the best telescope available at that time.
That was the best telescope available.
50 foot.
Yeah, right, for that kind of wavelength. Now, and I would have pursued that work further. Several other students working on this. Alan Barrett had gone down to NRL about that time, interested in radio astronomy, and had a couple of other students who were interested in radio astronomy. Bill Rose, Arno Penzias, and possibly a few others, and was working on radio astronomy. And then I was asked to go down to Washington to do what I considered was an important job, and I regretted very much having to leave, particularly when things were so interesting, and we were trying to build the first laser, and we're doing this work on radio astronomy. I was very much torn as to what I should do, but decided I really couldn't look myself in the mirror and turn down a possibility of doing something that I thought was important in national problems. So I was out there for 2 years.
This is what, 2 years now?
I was for this 59 to 61.
Can you tell me what this was? Or
59 to 61. Oh, yes. I was Director of Research for the Institute for Defense Analyses, which was working with the Defense Department, the State Department, to some extent with the President's Scientific Advisory Committee, and generally trying to look at security and policy problems, which were very troublesome in that time. Sputnik had just gone up, and people were very worried about the future in relation to the Soviet Union and what was going on. There weren't enough scientists in Washington, I felt, trying to help. Well, that was 59-61. Now, during that time, I also did a little work on the work in astronomy with a person there at the Institute of Defense Analysis who was interested, named Schwartz, trying to point out that in addition to communicating by radio with extraterrestrial life, there might be a possibility, or there was a possibility, of communicating by laser, that one should not be quite so restrictive in the frequency range over which considered such communication. But of course I was mainly busy with administrative type things and government problems, political and technological policy problems. Then from there I agreed to go to MIT. I went directly to MIT and then I was...
Excuse me, before we go any further, I wanted to backstep. I'm familiar with your paper from the Manchester Symposium in 55 about...
Oh yes, I forgot about that. Yes, I forgot about that. That was done while I was on sabbatical leave. Or about the time I was on sabbatical leave. I wrote that partly because I was interested, partly also because someone asked me, well now could I help out in saying what if there were any other things that might be looked for. And would I, and I said, well sure, there are a number of things I've been calculating and I think might be looked for, but I thought they were all fairly obvious sorts of things. However, I was prevailed on to give a kind of review paper. I was told that, well, astronomers didn't know as much about these things as they might, and would I please give a talk on what might be looked for. And it was because of that that I sort of prepared this thing. Many cases of the kinds of things I've been thinking about on my own notes, but not feeling they're worth publication. Thinking I might possibly work on them sometime, but I pulled all these things together on this paper in 55 and attended the meeting there in Manchester.
This, you say they were obvious to you, but I don't think they were obvious to other people, though, as you found out, perhaps.
Yes, yeah, I was surprised in a way. I was surprised in a way that that was the case. There were things which were, I felt, were sort of common to the field of microwave spectroscopy and ought to be pretty well known, and I felt it was really a question of looking and of a number of known things, but I was told that, well, many astronomers don't really know which ones are there, or might be there, which ones are more favorable, and would I please give a kind of a general discussion of what might be some of the more favorable ones. And I remember Vanderholtz being at least very gracious in thanking me for a helpful paper, and that I've been pleasantly surprised how useful, in fact, it has turned out to be.
Did you publish any of your calculations on continuum radiation?
No, I never published anything. No, I never published anything more then. Let's see.
So you were up to going to MIT.
Yeah, I went to MIT. Well, because at MIT I did, I was very much interested because I thought it was important for MIT to promote astronomy and astrophysics and try to help out there in building strong groups in astrophysics and encouraging Lincoln Laboratory and so on. And a number of people came to MIT during that time. Some people were friends of mine, people I know, Bernie Burke. Bernie Burke published a paper with me earlier in microwave spectroscopy. He was a student of Strandberg's, but he came down to Columbia. We worked together on one particular problem, so I knew him quite well, and Alan Barrett.
So I guess you were just too busy administratively at MIT.
I was pretty busy, and what work I was doing in the laboratory was on lasers, quantum electronics, non-linear optics. And when I left administrative work, was when I decided to do astrophysics. Now, my own personal astrophysics goes to some combination of radio astronomy and infrared astronomy, trying to cover a rather broader frequency range. It was, I guess, natural for me to go back to look for ammonia and some of the things that I'd always thought might be there. Astronomers weren't able to talk me out of the possibility that they might be there, although a number of astronomers tried.
When did you go to Berkeley?
I guess we were lucky and had two very good people, Dave Rank and Al Chung, to do it. I went there in 67.
So then you
fall of 67.
You must have started right in.
Started essentially immediately.
And the 20-foot nicely...
20-foot dish was available then. And one of the reasons I went to Berkeley was because of the combination of good radio facilities and good optical facilities there. Berkeley, of course, a strong astronomy department and people that were interested. So these are the... reasons I went there, and I felt that telescope would be very suitable for exploration of molecular lines, and Jack Welch turned out to be interested and very cooperative, and we started out to look for ammonia as the first one. Of course, as it turned out, there some molecules are still stronger. And ammonia, surprisingly, has not been explored much yet. But I think it will. Al Chung wants to do a thesis on that, and we'll of course explore it much more widely. I think undoubtedly there's more ammonia around to be found, and probably a good deal of.
So you're probably familiar with what Zuckerman and Palmer.
Yes, right. That's very nice additional results, and I think that and other things.
I was just going to ask you if there was anything in particular about the Hat Creek, whether in the discovery, any anecdotes or whatever that you remember with it. I mean, was it all a straightforward thing? You just built the radiometer and the filter bank?
So far ammonia is concerned, it was fairly straightforward. We knew what had to be done in order to try to look. We knew about what kind of precision we could get with the receivers available, and we wanted to use what equipment was available to look first. And we looked and there it was. We looked at a number of sources, of course. I think we had some advice from Professor Weaver as what would be some of the darker, bigger clouds, and we looked immediately for those.
You were trying to look in dust clouds, thinking they had to be protected.
Right. Yes, that's right. I was trying to specifically look in dust clouds, thinking that's where the molecules would most likely be, the highest concentration of matter, and where there was some protection. Now, there is an amusing anecdote in connection with water. I had not believed that the water line would be likely. I felt that, well, there we were at the right frequency and an antenna and good equipment, we might as well try it. And other people felt the same thing. Well, let's give it a try. We tried it in Sagittarius first, where we found the ammonia. And sure enough, there was a weak water line. It was very puzzling that it should be there. And along about Christmas time, I was having a Christmas party for all of our students and associates. And Al Chung, because he's a tremendous worker and an enthusiast, use that time. He had an opportunity to use the antenna, and I told him, by all means, go ahead and we'll have you to another party. So he missed the party, and he was up at Hat Creek looking at other sources in the water. And I got a call from him in the middle of this party while we were all drinking eggnog together. I'll call and said, well, it must be raining in Orion. It was an enormous signal. Lots of water. So we congratulated him, and we all drank a toast to the water in Orion.
And what about W49? I suppose that was even a greater surprise.
Yeah, that was still, of course, more intense.